tonight on Arena. Cormac Begley will be here playing live on his concertinas, and Tetris, Dungeons and Dragons and The Night of the 12th are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's Thursday night, and as always, we'll start with our film reviews. Three films for you this evening, two of which are video game related. The first began life as a tabletop role-playing game, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Amongst Thieves. It takes us on an epic quest. Is there any other kind of quest these days? And this is to retrieve, guess what, a long-lost relic. Next up, any kids of the early 1990s will, without doubt, remember the name Tetris, the addictive handheld video game that swept the world three decades ago. Our second movie tells the remarkable story about how the game was developed and marketed throughout the world. The movie is simply entitled Tetris. And finally then, Night of the 12th is a French film, true crime procedural drama based in Grenoble. Caro Doherty, Donald Clark have been to the cinema for us. And let's start with Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. This is not a film from the stable of the Marvel universe, although you could be forgiven for thinking so with the title of it. And when you talk about a tabletop game becoming a film, Donald, you kind of think, is there much really traction in that?
Well, you also think, is there anything else left to adapt? I mean, the phrase is intellectual property, IP. We're now at the stage where we're going back to 50-year-old role-playing games. I don't know if you remember this phenomenon, but it's been around ever since. But, I mean, before, when it came to role-playing, what's now called role-playing games now essentially is a term for a particular type of video game. But at that stage in the early 70s, that you had to have a dungeon master to plot all this out, and you had... I played a bit of this. I never got sufficiently into it to become any kind of expert. You had polyhedral dice, which you used for the battles, and it required an enormous amount of work to construct these imaginary worlds. Anyway, 50 years later, we've got the second film, or the second, it was a series of films at the start of the millennium. There have been video games based around that game. There was a cartoon series, which was quite popular as well. So you're not only are you asking the question, why are we adapting this 50-year-old role-playing game? You're asking the question, is that what we're really adapting? Or are we really making the various versions that come in between? And nothing about it is very promising. But this just goes to show, if you get the right people on board and they take the correct attitude towards the project, which is we're making a film first, we're not making a tribute to or to whatever this IP we're hacking away, we're actually first of all concerned with making a film that functions as a film, then you can have a successful product, which they have, this thing has worked out far better than we could possibly have imagined.
When I kind of set it up, I thought, could this really be as good as everybody's saying it is? And Cara, I think you're in a similar boat when it comes to this film as Don. Donald, maybe explain to us who Chris Pine is and what he's doing here. First of all, he's in a bad enough foul state, to be fair to the character, as the film, beg your pardon, begins. Edgin Darvis, is that how I say his name, the character?
Poor old Edgin. He's a harper, which means he's part of a secret society. He has lots of enemies. And the enemies, they kill his wife and they leave him and his little daughter, Kira, who he's very much struggling, he's grieving, he's become a drunk, and he's a bit of a disaster area. And he knows two things. He knows if he has to protect this child, but he also knows there is a doohickey, the Tablet of Reawakening, and if he can find that, he can bring his wife back. But that's easier said than done, because he's become very fond of the owl ale. So he's in the tavern, drowning his sorrows, when he comes across Holga Kilgore, played by Michelle Rodriguez, and she's a barbarian. Now, you think barbarian, she's going to be a bit evil, but no, she is a barbarian with a big heart, and she falls for this poor drunken fool and the child. They're purely friends, but they form this strange little bond, this little family who are going to raise this child and become professional thieves, which they're very good at until they get caught.
They're doing very well until that happens. One other character I need to know about before I play the clip, Cara, then maybe you'd give me who Simon is in this. This is the Justice Smith character.
Poor old Simon. They need a wizard, and you would think in Dungeons & Dragons there's some really amazing wizards, but poor old Simon, he's more likely to turn you into a frog than save you. He has confidence issues, but they need help, so he gets roped into their merry band. But yeah, he's definitely nervous and he can't quite get his magic to work.
All right, well, let's listen to a clip that features Chris Pine as Egin, Michelle Rodriguez as Holga, Doric, who's the daughter character played by Sophia Lillis, and Simon, Justice Smith, arrive in a graveyard to question the talisman who's buried in a plot somewhere in there. And that's a graveyard plot rather than the plot of the film. Simon awakens the talisman, and then Egin, the Chris Pine character, takes over with questions. And he doesn't work out quite as well as he might have hoped.
Okay, Simon, how does this work?
All right. Once the dead man is revived, we can ask him 5 questions, at which point he will die again, mm-hmm. never to be re-revived.
Why 5 questions?
I don't know. That's just how it works.
Seems arbitrary.
Can we get on with this, please?
Right. Yes. Perlamon Tergatis. Maybe I'm not saying it right. I wasn't scared, nearly startled.
Here we go. Were you killed in the Battle of the Evermoors?
Yes.
Great. I mean, not for you. Sorry for your loss. 4 more questions, right?
Yes.
No, that wasn't for you. Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it. Only answer when I talk to you, okay?
Yes.
Why did you say okay at the end of that?
I didn't.
Fantastic. Where's the shovel?
That's Chris Pine as Egin, Michelle Rodriguez in there as Holga, Sophia Lillis as Doric, and Justice Smith as Simon in a scene from Dungeons and Dragons. And immediately, I was relieved, Donald, to know you don't get bogged down in plot here. They're having fun with this. But we're part, you know, sometimes these people have fun and you're thinking, that's great, but not, where are we in the equation? They're bringing us with them as they have fun.
It's a pure comedy, and there's no question about that. But it also has a surprisingly successful emotional undertow, particularly towards the end. The relationship between Michelle Rodriguez and Chris Pine is a really nice one. It's that sort of spiky, he's kind of, in many ways, she's playing the male role in traditional terms of the relationship. She's kind of the aggressive, forceful character, and he's the character who needs to be a little bit more seduced as the film moves on. But it works for that reason, as you said, because the comedy is terrific, and the comedy is, in instances like the scene we've just heard, very close to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But the Sanctum is also very much a romantic thing going on, which suggested to me a certain amount of The Princess Bride. Now, it's not on the scale of the quality of The Princess Bride, but they're certainly kind of travelling in the same territory. And you can get away with an awful lot if you cast as well as you've cast here, and not least, we haven't yet mentioned Hugh Grant, who's gone through a very interesting cycle over the past 30 years or so. That, I mean, it seems an awfully long time ago. Well, it was over 30 years, when he emerged and he was this amiable, bumbling sort in 4 Weddings and a Funeral, and somewhere in there that he gathered this slightly malign quality, as an actor, I stress. Yeah. I'm not talking about Hugh Grant himself, who I'm sure is a lovely individual, but as an actor, he gathered this slightly malign quality. So whenever he appears on the screen, you immediately don't trust, however charming he may be seen to be. And there's actually not a huge distance here between the character he plays here and the character he played in Paddington 2,
right,
where again he is this character who emerged with sort of name from Nancy Mitford and an apparently ingratiating manner. And the minute he appears, you think, yeah, you're a bad one, which he proves to be.
He's called Forge Fitzwilliam, you know,
exactly.
So you know he's called.
That actually telegraphs the fact that this is not a fellow you can trust.
No, let's have a quick listen to him. You got to picture him now on top of a huge pillar in the middle of a Colosseum-style arena, and he's opening what we call the games.
What a profound joy it is to welcome you, the good people of Neverwinter, to the resumption of the High Sun Game. Do not leave the arena till the close of the games, as there will be a wonderful gift for each and every one of you.
All right, take me down. This is absurdly high. It's not what we discussed.
It's not what we discussed, says Forge Fitzwilliam, played by Hugh Grant in Dungeons and Dragons. And Cara, we're in Northern Ireland. What is it about Northern Ireland and these kind of medieval settings that it seems to love to portray?
the most fantastic landscapes and locations. But actually, what one of the things that's different in this is we saw it dark and damp and cold and foggy in Game of Thrones for so long. But in this, they shot in the summertime. It's so green. It's so lush. I mean, it just looks magical. So it's definitely seeing Northern Ireland from a much lighter point than we normally see it on screen. Really, absolutely looks fantastic. And what really helps is they built most of the sets. They use practical effects. There's so few CGI. They created all these fabulous creatures and doohickeys and watsons, and just that brings that extra dimension of life to it.
There's a clunk and weight to it, I think, which is very satisfying.
And did you, Cara, similar to Donald, did you get that kind of emotional heft towards the end that was possibly unexpected in something that's so lighthearted in many ways?
Very much so, and it is, as Donald said, that Princess Bride way. Yeah, it hits you at a few points. There's a lovely sense of family. I mean, they're a right bunch of vagabonds and weirdos, but they connect, and that kind of combination of heart and humour, plus some really great action sequences to the end, really has, it has all those magical qualities.
Right, so director John S. Byrd, take a bow, it sounds like, for casting well and for directing well. Stars for you, from you first of all on this one, Cara?
Oh, definitely 4. I could almost edge towards the 4.5, really. And it's so much fun. It's one of those films I want to see again with a bunch of friends. Right. Definitely.
Okay. And Donald?
I'd happily give it 4. I hope people go and see it. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. It's not always easy to get people to see even populist films these days, but we'll see. Certainly, but 4 stars, yes, sure, no question.
A very solid 4 then from both Donald and Cara. For Dungeons and Dragons. Let us move on then to another film based on a game. This time it's a popular video game. Tetris features falling blocks of colour that feed into our universal desire to create order out of chaos. That's the game we're talking about there. The movie moves away from the game itself to tell the story about how it was first devised, developed and marketed through the world. It's a very different story in that respect, Cara. It's not a kind of a trying to reinvent the game itself or to display the game itself. It's about the politics behind getting one of those games and marketing around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It turns out that Tetris was designed by an Alexei Pajitnov, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, in Russia in 1984. But it's communism and he can't make money from anything he's designed. So he gives it to friends and colleagues and it takes over Russia. Everyone's playing it. But it's a Hank Rogers played by Taron Egerton, who is a game developer, and he's a bit kind of charming, a bit kind of shady as well. Discovers the game at a gaming convention in Nevada and buys the rights to sell it and market it in Japan, where he lives with his family. And it's from here that he begins to realize rights are not a straightforward thing, especially when you have other interested parties like Sega, Atari and the Maxwell media moguls all trying to get their hands to market it in different places. And what they don't actually realize is that sitting in Moscow is a bunch of people who don't quite realise the extent of what's going on in the outside world with their game.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a listen to Edgerton, Taron Egerton as Hank Rogers. And here he is explaining those Soviet origins of the game Tetris.
It all began with a guy named Alexei Leonidovich Pajitnov 4 years ago. By day, he worked as a programmer for the government of the Soviet Computer Science Center. But by night, he invented games for fun. His computer, a Stone Age Soviet piece of crap called an Electronica 60, didn't even have a graphics card. His falling blocks were parentheses pushed together. Alexei and a couple of buddies from work made the game IBM compatible, which meant color graphics, 8-bit music, and floppy disks that people copied and shared for free. It spread like wildfire.
Taron Egerton there as Hank Rogers in the film Tetris. And Donald Clark, I'm wondering about the tone of this film, because there's a feeling of a documentary about it in some ways. There's a feeling of a docudrama about it, but there's also a kind of a comedic tone in there too.
Well, very much so, and I think it functions as a comedy as much as anything else. I mean, if anything, it's a bit too packed. I mean, you hear about this notion, it's odd actually, that there's now a whole kind of stream of films coming our way about the launch of products. Next week, Air comes out about the launch of the Air Jordan, which is also basically about someone trying to get a name on a contract, which is what we have here, which is not necessarily the most promising subject for a film. But it's almost two-part because, I mean, actually, your first thoughts would be, what do I care about how they came to market or how they came to earn the rights to Tetris or any other video game? But in fact, it's got all this stuff woven in. So it has the end of the USSR, which is looming. It has the launch of the Game Boy, which is kind of the product worship part of it all. And it has the Maxwell thing, which is fascinating. If you're kind of, you know, our sort of age and lived through...
So Robert Maxwell is the kind of the villain of the piece here.
Essentially, yes. I mean, the head of Mirror Group, who I'd forgotten if I ever knew, but it had an interest in software at this stage. And so we know that down the road, if you knew anything about the Maxwell Group, that in the few years after the incidents in this film, he vanished off the back of his boat after a scandal involving the pensions in the Mirror Group. So that's all looming as well. And so there's enormous potential to do all kinds of anything that's a bit too busy for that reason. The one, I think, you know, unquestioned, well, there's a few unquestioned successes. I think Edgerton himself was very good, always a charming actor, and the fact that we know him as that charming version of Elton John, and Eddie the Eagle, in the Eddie the Eagle film, which I really recommend to people if they haven't seen it, it's another example of a film which should be terrible, but it's actually great. But by casting him, you're saying to us, we are identifying with Hank as a hero of the people, because that's one of the things that Taron Egerton does. But the other unadulterated success, I think, in this, or unquestioned success in this, is Roger Allam as Maxwell, who has a whale of a time, no pun intended, with layers of latex on him, you know, fattened up, and he just absolutely revels the opportunity to play this notorious character.
And Toby Jones is in there as well, Cara. He's one of the competitors, or another gamer. Does he want to get his hands on Tetris too?
He does. He's a broker, and he's working for the Maxwells, or is he? Is he working for his own interests?
Right.
It's a little bit hard. He's part of the convoluted negotiations, but he's embedded in the middle of this. He's in Moscow, and God bless his wit, he is trying to double cross the KGB, which is not going to get you very far.
Not a good plan. And as Donald was describing it too, it sounds like a convoluted story that has the possibility of getting bogged down in itself. Does it do that?
Oh, definitely. It is. It's just unnecessarily convoluted, and the jigs and reels of the rights, that's not straightforward anyway.
Yeah.
But there's too much and too many things getting thrown into it, and that trying to find its balance between comedy and drama, but it muddles itself, and yet it's still enjoyable, but it could have been a far better film.
All right.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating because it gets a bit lost, and everything in here has the potential to work like gangbusters, even down to the fact that I think they rather overdo the use of the computer graphics. So there's kind of a gag where you see, like, you know, low-grade and also 8-bit video game music being used as the soundtrack is over. It's all a bit over-egged. It doesn't pull it apart, but it ultimately always feels like it should be a little bit better.
Stars?
Three.
Three, and what are you saying on this, Cara?
Yeah, I go with three as well. It doesn't always work, but, you know, it just kind of suck you in at times as well.
All right, so three, kind of middle of the road, that sounds like to me. Finally then, The Night of the 12th, a French film, true crime procedural drama is what we're talking about in this case. What is the true crime that has been dealt with here, Donald?
It is the murder, a gruesome murder, I believe it was originally in Paris, of a young girl who is doused in petrol and set alight. A number of police officers then gather and start investigating the various suspects, of which there are many, and all of them seem plausible. It's an interesting structure, this, because I wonder, is it possible for the first thing that you see in a film to count as a spoiler? Obviously, the filmmakers think not, because they've got it right there at the beginning.
Yeah.
They tell us that, right at the beginning, that The Night of the 12th is based on an unsolved case. Yet, as a viewer, inevitably, because we're so wired into genre, and wired into this particular genre in particular, you feel that some kind of resolution is bound to come our way, and maybe it does. To say more than that, well, it would be a spoiler. But we definitely do get, I think, quite a fresh take on a very familiar professional structure, that is the procedural drama, played out, I think, in quite elegant lines, at quite a leisurely pace. And I think they make some interesting choices here. The decision to move the real-life case, which I think, say, was in Paris, from Paris to Grenoble in the shadow of the Alps, is a smart one. I mean, partly for the trivial reason that you allow these elegant compositions to play out while the action's taking place, and also because it allows Dominic Moll, the director, directed Harry, He's Here to Help, a decade or so ago, an excellent French director, to focus on the action, free from the distractions of all that metropolitan buzz.
Yeah.
And the message, I mean, there's a very strong feminist argument going through this that makes for an interesting crime plot, that, which is that, essentially, at one point, the girl's friend, in what could be a melodramatic point, but actually a melodramatic line, but actually works quite well, says, all men killed her. And you get that sense that a woman, you know, blameless woman is killed, and yet, despite that, nonetheless, despite the fact there is no real motive to kill her, there are men all around the place who could have done so and seem likely suspects to have done so.
The other side, as well as the obviously the crime itself and the solving of that crime or not solving, as the case may be in the film, we have to have two police officers. Give me a sense, if you would, Cara, of Johan and is he Marco? The Sebastian Bouillon as Johan and Bully Lanners as Marco. Interesting dynamic between these two detectives.
Johan, he's newly commissioned and he's got quite a fresh approach. He's also very diligent. He's kind of ticking every single box. He wants to get to the bottom of this. Marceau is a lot older. He is going through personal issues. He's very melancholic, and both of them are bringing that into work. Marceau, he really is miserable. I mean, his marriage is falling apart. So, but his misery affects the case in a very different way to kind of Johan's need to solve this. And it does show very well how at the end of the day, a crime is committed, but people do inject their personal lives into a case. Because it really goes into that. But kind of Marceau is so laden down by his misery, and Johan, being that bit younger, starts to see how much sexism is in his own unit, as the men all men at the start, and every single one of them they're not particularly that fussed about solving this murder, because you know she's just another girl at the end of the day who's been killed by possibly by a former lover. And Johan starts to see how very wrong that this kind of continual system and how much it needs to change.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of victim blaming that goes on. But then a character called Nadia joins the investigative team. What does she bring to the mix, Cara?
Well, she's also she is. I think I'm not sure what her heritage is, but she isn't white, and she has the burden of both that facing an entire squad of men, and she's just sick and tired of everything, and that kind of fires Johan to try and help get this case finally sorted out.
And I guess it both probably displays more misogyny and also gives a chance for a female voice to be brought into the equation. But it is based on facts, so they're not making that bit up. But the other thing about procedurals, Donald, the potential here, a bit like what we were saying about Tetris, the potential to get bogged down in tiny little details, but you need to know each detail to get to the next stage of the crime investigation. Does it manage that?
I think it does. I think it's very clear. I think that in terms of the practicalities of the clues and the structure of the story, if you can call it a story, because it has that it has the random quality of real life, I think it's laid out very clearly, so you always know exactly where you sit. I mean, it has the look of a TV series like Happy Valley or one of the recent filed German adaptations. I would not be the first critic to compare it to Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder, which is one of the films that Bong Joon-ho broke through with 10 or 15 years ago. But they all had that kind of more traditional momentum that you have in a crime story. But I think this doesn't have that, but still gets away with it, partly because that environment is so well fleshed out. It economically lays out the tensions in their lives. And also because it's honest about where we're going. It invites you into a surprise or not going.
Yeah.
And there is, towards the end, there's one really strange thing where there seems to be a clue I detected. And nothing happens from it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, well, give me your stars then on in terms of Night of the 12th. Donald first?
At 4.
A solid 4 from Donald. Where are you on this one, Cara?
I got very annoyed about the fact that this film is basically saying that women should not be judged for their pasts, that their victimhood is not based on their previous relationships. Yet we don't learn anything about Clara. All of it is done through her past. So it's kind of, it's just this frustrating thing of not really practicing what it's preaching. It is very good and well acted, but I'm going to go with a 3.5 because I just got very annoyed
at that
by a real life character not actually being anything other than, you know, somebody who slept with lots of people.
All right. Cara O'Doherty and Donald Clark are two reviewers tonight. The Night of the 12th, Dungeons and Dragons, and Tetris, the three movies. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, and I'm delighted now to be joined in studio by the acclaimed concertina player Cormac Begley, who's in Dublin to promote his headline Dublin gig at Vicar Street on April the 23rd. He will also be the guest of Ye Vagabonds at their concert in Vicar Street tomorrow and Saturday night. Delighted to have you here. I know you're going to start with a great track, but there's a great story behind this track that I want to hear. And it has to do with the Irish phrase, Cadeshin Dantashin.
Yeah, well, this morning, firstly, thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here with you again, Sean. But today I was in Hall on the Marie, and it's one of the most westerly halls in West Kerry. And I was playing music with my sister, Cliona, in Hall on the Marie for about 100 students from Gaeltacht schools back in Westford Ingle. And a guy called Christy McNamara had been teaching them for years, but it was kind of a getting together and a day out for the kids. And I came straight from there, and I was trying to think what I'd play for you tonight, and I decided to play the tune Cadeshin Dantashin, because it reminds me of my grandfather who used to run that dance hall back in the 60s. And it wasn't very popular within the clergy to be running Gaelies on Christmas Eve. And he'd done it for a number of years, and the clergy and the priest and the church used to say that the devil was back in that hall. My grandfather was once interviewed by Joe Duffy, and Joe Duffy asked him, how did he deal with the pressure from the clergy? And my grandfather simply said, we ignored them. Mm. So this tune reminds me of my grandfather, because the tune roughly translates as what I do with my life, and as long as I'm not hurting anybody, it's really none of your business. So there's a kind of defiance in the attitude to this tune.
Yeah, there's a sense of, what is it to you?
Yeah.
What business is it of yours?
Yeah, exactly.
And I was listening to you playing it earlier on as we were doing our sound checks, and I thought, if the concertina was going to tell you to get lost, now I possibly used a slightly more colourful language when we were talking about it earlier, but if the concertina was going to tell you to get lost and mind your own business, this is how the instrument would do it.
Yeah.
Right, okay, let's have a listen. Cadeshin Dantashin. Absolutely gorgeous stuff. Cadeshin Dantashin is how it kind of started out, that tune, Cormac.
Yeah.
It went a few other places then after that, didn't it? We had three tunes altogether, however, or had we four? No, we had three.
Three tunes, and the second one is called An Gael Óglaig, or The Gallow Glass, which is probably in honour of my grandfather too, of that lineage, because the Begleys going back were mercenary warriors.
Beag Óglaig.
Small warriors or small heroes. So, and then the third one, I don't have a name for it. But
What's extraordinary is the physicality of you playing. People cannot have seen just how much you move as you play. They've heard you stomping the feet and really been involved in it. But you're really out of breath playing it. And that's, in terms of your concertina, is the one that you were playing there is a small enough one, and it's very agile, very lithe.
Yes.
Which particular concertina is that, first of all? And then talk to me about the physicality.
Well, this is a treble concertina. It's probably the most common.
The standard one.
And a German-made instrument. Jürgen Suttner made it, a great maker in Germany. But it's the lighter instrument. The physicality, I've actually spent two nights down in Ballydehob with an instrument repairer called Stephen Chambers, and he doesn't like to see me coming because he spent 2 days trying to repair the bellows. I try and embody the some of the tunes and the meaning of the tunes, like the intention of the tunes or the intention of the composer of the tune. And if you're agile and been able to adapt yourself to the intention of different pieces of music, it kind of manifests physically in the instrument, whether it's in a soft, slow air or a lighter tune to something with the attitude of caudation, dentation.
Yeah, so. Which is a little bit more sarky, I suppose, and not quite as on the nose. It's a little bit more pulled back. But it also struck me that it makes total sense then that you would have been involved with Michael Keegan Dolan of Chuck Dowser on Mom, because, I mean, that physical side of that, the particular dance show, the physical side of your playing fits right in with that.
Yeah, and Michael was brilliant to work with. I learned so much from Michael and his process, and working with the dancers and everyone involved, but in particular the dancers and Michael's way of working and trying to embody the music. And a lot of credit going to Michael.
And while I know that obviously it's a solo show in Vicar Street, there will be others in along with you, and you've such a broad range of collaborators across different genres and different styles. I mean, Ye Vagabond, you're going to be playing in their show as well. When did that kind of collaborative process start between yourself and Brian and Dermot?
Well, I got to know them years ago, I'd say 5 or 6 years ago, and seen them around the sea, like around Dublin, as I was living in Dublin at the time. And we met in Trinity College one time and in Walsh's, and we just sat in playing tunes together. We ended up doing a music network tour together as well. But since, for the last 3 or 4 years, we've been playing a lot together. It was the last shows we did before lockdown, during lockdown, when we had the opening, we ended up playing around 10 shows around. And we've been playing together since, and recently recorded on their album, which is great. It's great to be involved with them, yeah.
And Peaky Blinders, of course. We had Lisa O'Neill talking to us about the final scene of Peaky Blinders. You're in there with her.
Yeah, well, Lisa's amazing. Lisa's one of a kind and a great friend. And she's a great person to be around. So I was delighted when we got the call and she called me to be involved in that particular project. We ended up recording that up in Cabin Teely and spent two nights there, Ruth O'Mahony and Colin McInumera, and special time and special project involved in it.
And did you actually see the final episode? Because you're a big fan of Peaky Blinders.
I'm actually not. I never watched Peaky Blinders until I got the call for that. But we were working with the visuals of that last scene, and I've gotten into it since. I think I'm in the second series at the moment. I'm trying to catch up to the end.
And the fact that it was a Bob Dylan song, had you been a big fan of his work previous to that? His songs.
I knew who he was. I knew some of the songs, but no, I wouldn't call myself a big fan. So I kind of felt like a bit of maybe an outsider.
But brings an interesting perspective, though, when it's not, in inverted commas, your style of music, you know. Maybe that rubbing of the two different genres together is an interesting alchemy.
I think so, and I put that down to Lisa's judgment, and she must have seen something and asked me to be involved in that. But I find those collaborations in particular, like with Ye Vagabonds and Lisa, they're very, very challenging because they're outside of... they're kind of outside my bread and butter. I love playing traditional music. That's where I've come from. I'm very fortunate to play it and still play with some of my favourite musicians. But I do enjoy the challenge of playing with different
Of course, the ultimate collaboration that happens in your own case is with the family. I mean, you talked about playing with your sister this morning, in fact, in West Kerry. And, you know, I couldn't let the moment pass. I haven't seen you since the death of your uncle Seamus, McCovron. I live August Dunclown Galera, and I'm sure everybody around the country was so shocked by that awful news. But it was another blow in a very bad year for the family, a difficult year for the family.
Very difficult 6 months between the burning of our ancestral home, the house that Seamus and my father and all my aunties and uncles grew up in. It was there for 250 years, and it was strange that the night that, like, the Footsparn had a tent up in my uncle's field, and for having a weekend festival, there's a weekend festival on up there, and on the Saturday night, the house went up in flames, and Seamus, God rest him, he spent the following months clearing out the house, and he worked more or less by himself. Like, I don't know anybody who worked as hard as Seamus. He was something else. Like, he helped me he helped me 2 years ago for about 3 weeks, and helped my mother in terms of like clearing out places for around the house. And he'd be up at 8 o'clock, yeah, beeping tractor waking us up, and he'd be working until 9 o'clock at night. But we'll miss him very much.
He's a singer and an accordion player. I mean, the concertina isn't that far away. It's a very close relative of the accordion. Was Seamus an influence on you in terms of the playing?
Big time, yeah. Massive influence. And not just the music. Like, he's a great singer, great musician, accordion player. But he massive impact just outside of musically. He's an uncle to some of my closest cousins, and spent a lot of time when I was around over in Ballinabuck. And he's a larger than life figure. He had such an impact on so many people and so many different networks and so many friends around the place. So we're lucky to have had him.
Yeah. Well, listen, and I know Shlina Bioglich is back on in the TG car, yourself and the dog on around in Beauty the Van.
Yes, yeah, she's
looking
still going.
Looking forward to another little bit of that. However, you did bring the second concertina in with you.
I did.
So what is the second concertina and what are we going to hear?
I'm going to play the bass concertina.
This is the big boy.
This is the big one. So it's a good thing I won't be chatting after this. this is a Dipper bass concertina, and I'm going to play O'Neill's Cavalcade.
And one of the things I love about this is your use of the air as a kind of, it's almost, but it becomes a drum as much as it is a concertina.
Yes, yeah.
Your instrument maker, I'm sure, loves that. You're a repairman.
He does.
All right. Well, listen, you get yourself set up there, and I'll give people details of all of the gigs that are coming up, etc. But here we have Cormac Begley and O'Neill's Cavalcade. It sounds like a person breathing. It actually sounds like a living being, and the way you put it in, I'm tempted to ask you to sing a song, Cormac. That Cormac Begley out of breath there after giving us O'Neill's Cavalcade. Cormac plays Vicar Street on April the 23rd, his own solo gig. There will be lots of surprise guests, and I think he'll be teasing us with those over the coming weeks. VicarStreet.com for bookings for that. And he's in part, he'll be in Vicar Street as well as part of the Ye Vagabonds gigs, which are tomorrow night, March the 31st, and the night afterwards, April the 1st. So there'll be a bit of fun, I would have thought, on that night as well. Cormac Mila Buekas, as Chuck the Chat thing. Cormac Begley, great joy to have you here. Lessons in Kindness is the second poetry collection from Danny Gill. The book divides into four sections: grief, contracts, mirrors and truth. And it explores, among other things, identity, sexuality, the public versus the private world, and indeed kindness itself. Delighted that Danny Gill joins me from our Galway studio this evening. An absolutely beautiful dedication in the opening pages of the collection, Danny. For my grandmother, it reads, "In your echo, I stand." I mean, stopped me in my tracks when I read it. It was almost like a little poem in and of itself, it has to be said. Tell me a little bit about her, because she was part of your first collection as well, wasn't she, After Love?
She was. She was in After Love. She was, I diagnosed with her brain disease when I was writing that book. So she appeared in a series in that collection. And in this collection, she had passed away, so the poems in this book deal with that. But she was a huge person in my life. I mean, grandmothers tend to be matriarchal figures for a lot of people, but Gran, she had great zest for life. She was a very strong woman. She had a brilliant sense of humour, and her passing was a very kind of a critical moment.
And I suppose the fact that the opening section of the collection is called Grief, a lot of the grief within that, it struck me, seems to speak directly to that particular loss in your life. Maybe you'd introduce us to the poem Hollow and explain where it fits into the overall grief aspect of that opening section, Danny.
Sure. A Hollow is a poem about my mother finding a baby bird on the pavement outside of her house a few weeks after Granny had passed away. And she described the experience to me. So that's where the poem came from. Hollow. The tiny bird rescued in the weeks after, gathered into a towel, motherless. Its silent O. The mouth you remember she made when her words had left her. This baby mark, the shape of unheard vowels, the need to tuck in, mother it like a mother, the child you were, the child she was.
Danny Gill reading her poem Hollow, and that's from Danny's new collection, Lessons in Kindness. It's an interesting title, Lessons in Kindness. And you're certainly not preaching lessons in kindness at us, Danny. In fact, I think in many ways, how much are you talking to yourself about lessons in kindness, as in being kind to yourself?
Yeah, the title comes from a poem called Shingles, and it's about getting shingles on my 30th birthday. And definitely the book, a lot of it is about self-compassion and self-love and alchemizing from difficult situations to find your kindness and your compassion, and I suppose for yourself and then for others who are in your life. And I was having a lot of experiences in writing the book that were linked to that. So it sounds like a very soft title in some ways. I know a lot of people like the title, but it is about kind of overcoming difficulty too, and kind of having to search for the good and the hope and the strength from tough situations.
Yeah, and particularly if we look at the name of the title of the second section, Contracts, we're into a much more clinical kind of title in some ways in that word. In some ways you're talking about agreements with yourself here, agreements with others, and the way you have to navigate agreements to get on with your life.
Yeah, and Contracts, I suppose that title of that section is very deliberate, because it is about, I guess, being born into and maybe socially trained into situations where we are kind of bound or feel bound to them. And that whole section is kind of about breaking that and breaking rules. And I suppose I chose in this book to write about my sexuality very openly, and the poems in this section kind of pertain to that. The openers are kind of love poems, and then it kind of goes into the more turbulent side of that topic.
Maybe you'd give us an introduction then into the poem Heart Blown Open, which is within this contract section.
Sure. Heart Blown Open was inspired by a conversation I had with an amazing woman, a dancer in her 70s, who confided in me over lunch one day and had told me that she was bisexual and she had fallen in love with a woman in college. And she described that experience of her heart being blown open. So this is about one of my first relationships with a woman, Heart Blown Open. When she fell in love, she said that her heart was blown open, that it took years to pick up the pieces, a shatter, not knowing what to do next, how to love cleverly. Her face was so soft in my hands that first summer. Compassless, I found my way around her body, and the fireworks were not instantaneous or colourful. It was just the stillness of a heart blown open, soundless mornings waking, wearing only the love she gave me.
Heart Blown Open from Danny Gill's new collection, Lessons in Kindness. You talked there, Danny, about, you know, how in some ways the contract section of the book from which that poem comes is about maybe breaking contracts or maybe knocking down expectations that there may have been around for people in general, but specifically it's a very personal sense of expectation here, I think, expectations around you. How difficult was it to write about your sexuality in such an open way and in such a public way?
I mean, it is very exposing, and I suppose I'm thinking about it more acutely now as the book kind of comes to market and people are going to engage with it. But I suppose I've always been writing about my life, and you know, there's a quote in the book by Adrienne Rich about telling the truth and how that enables other people to tell the truth. And I think that marriage equality in Ireland was a huge step for the LGBTQ+ community, but we still have a long way to go. And, you know, 2022 is a record year for attacks and incidents of violence for people in that community. And I think there are still a lot of struggles for us, and active allyship is very important. And I felt it was important then to include frank poems about my own experience, because, you know, a lot of people are actually having that experience, and I suppose there's an opportunity to put it in the public domain in a way that might help or at least highlight.
In the section Mirrors, you, in some ways you look at the kind of looking at yourself, or if you like, or looking at the kind of performative aspects of yourself. It struck me how, you know, if you're a poet, you have to, you have certain expectations, you have to behave in a certain way in your poet persona. You also curate festivals and put programmes together. There's a certain expectation, a type of behaviour that's expected in that role as well. How difficult was it to get past those roles to get into the very heart of yourself and put it down on the page?
Very hard. I mean, I sometimes think, had I met myself now, you know, if a future me would have spoken to me 10 years ago and told me things I would have been doing, I would have been horrified, you know, and shocked. And I think, you know, you find ways to be brave, and I found being more vulnerable has actually made me a stronger person. And you find your people, and others, I think, have permission then, you know, to talk or to speak. But for sure, I think everyone has a public and a private persona.
Well, maybe we'll finish with your real encouragement for people to speak out and tell the truth from the truth section of the book. Will you finish with Raise Your Spear?
I will. Thank you, Sean. Raise Your Spear. Last week in Dublin, they called my friend a faggot, threw eggs from a passing car. This is not the country we think we live in. The first time I get a funny look putting my arm around my girlfriend in a bar, I remember that in another country I could get stoned for this. Then the judgment seems like a small hate. The lump in my throat, preparing to say it. Stepping out of a box I didn't make. The violence of freedom, the price we pay.
And that's Danny Gill with her poem Raise Your Spear, and that is from her new collection Love in Kindness. Love in Kindness is published by Salmon Poetry. Danny Gill is at the Coorch Festival in Galway on the 21st of April. You'll get full details on coorch.ie. And After Love, which is Danny's dance show in and around her first collection, is at the Black Box in Galway on the 1st of April, and then at Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin on the 6th of April. You can find out full details on smockalley.com. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.